My name is Mallory. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mallory.
My sobriety date is July 10th, 2010, and I have a home group, which is Preamblers in Charlottesville, and I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I work with her on a regular basis and work with other alcoholics as part of my recovery, and it's been a huge part of my recovery. I grew up in the northern neck of Virginia as an only child to two parents who were together, and I thought that my life was great. I thought that I grew up spoiled rotten like I thought everyone should, and that, you know, I had a really good life. And I was the oldest grandchild on one side and the youngest on the other, so I was spoiled in that way too. My mom's parents were really excited to have their first grandchild, and my dad's parents were thrilled when I came because everyone else was kind of growing up and I was the baby. I learned really early on when I went to school that just because I was the youngest and the oldest in the family, it wasn't all about Mallory, because it had been that way for quite a while until I went to school. I went to private school all my life, and when I, in preschool, I remember lying. I got in trouble, and I got sent to the principal's office in preschool for lying. And, well, you'll hear the story. I got sent to the principal. They called my mom, told her she needed to come in because I continually lied. And I had told this story about falling through the ceiling or falling through the floor in the basement and ending up in the kitchen wall at my grandmother's house. And it was the truth, but I lied so much they didn't believe me, and they told me I couldn't tell stories at school. So, you know, the teacher already knew I was a liar in preschool. So I made a lot of friends. No matter who they put me beside, I talked to them until they talked back. And I have always just wanted people to like me. I'm always worried about what people think of me. But I'm going to tell you I don't care. But I really do. I'm sure none of you can relate to that. I started feeling like, probably in middle school, I started feeling like I just wasn't the same as the rest of the kids. I was like a little heavier than them. I liked to play softball, but I wasn't as good as the fit little girls. And I just compared myself out in every aspect all the time. You know, the boys would make fun of me because, like, I got boobs early and, you know, stuff like that. And it was just so embarrassing. And I just wanted to hide. I didn't want attention drawn to me, but yet I wanted attention. So my parents had this business. Well, my dad had this business. And he sold boats. He worked on boats. He had this big company. All these people worked for him. And when I was getting ready to go into high school, he filed bankruptcy and closed this business. And this business had provided for our family. It's what made me spoiled. I had everything that I ever wanted, and all of a sudden everything was gone, including our home, our vehicles, everything that I cared about with the material stuff. And my life changed dramatically the day that he told me that he was closing the business. We ended up losing our house and moving in with my mom's family. I lived upstairs in my grandparents' house, and my parents lived in their garage apartment for about 2 years until they got back on their feet and built a house close to my grandparents. My mom told me that they weren't going to be able to afford to send me to private school, and I totally understood, kind of, and I agreed to go to public school. So I went to this public school for about 3 weeks, and I sat in class, and I knew everything that they were teaching me 3 years ago. They tried advancing me to AP classes, and I knew that stuff. So I went home and I cried to my grandparents because that works. And they put me in private school for the rest of the, you know, my years in school. And I started that summer, right before high school, going to this friend's house whose parents drank a lot. And her and I would, like, hang out in her room. We'd go out in the kitchen late at night, and we'd, like, swig her dad's Jack Daniels and sneak her stepmom's Smirnoffs. And then we'd wake up really sick the next day. But we'd do it again the next night. And I didn't realize it then, but I think I just, you know, I had that change where it made me feel different, and I liked doing it. And we started sneaking off to a lot of parties with boys, and I was playing softball, travel ball. I ended up going to college to play softball with a scholarship. And when I went to Virginia Beach to college after graduating, I was a catcher, and I was really, really involved in softball. It was my life, and it was really important to me. And nothing was going to get in the way of softball and my degree. So I went to practice every day. I did everything that I was supposed to do, but I was drinking. And I lived on a girls' dorm hall. There was 28 girls and like 7 shower stalls, and I was the popular girl. Everyone came to my room, and it was like the local living room, you know? And we hung out. We had a good time, and I always had alcohol to give everybody. And I'm going to say now, I would never have admitted it then, but it was all stolen. At one point, I looked around my dorm room and realized that everything I had was stolen. I went in stores and stole clothes because my parents couldn't provide what I thought I deserved. I went in convenience stores and I stole bottles. I mean, I was just brave, I guess. I don't know. But that's who I was. And, I mean, none of them knew this. They had no idea. They just thought, Mallory's a rich girl, and it's really fun to hang out in her room. I mean, they used to say it all the time. None of them knew what I had been through in college. They didn't know that what I had been through, like, right before high school, because I didn't want them to know. So, long story short, I ended up getting kicked off the softball team because of my attitude and because I couldn't stay sober. I was showing up puking at practice because I couldn't run because I was so hungover, and just, you guys know how it goes. So another thing that I didn't mention, my dad's family, I grew up going to my grandmother's house like every Sunday for family day, whatever that means. And we used to always sit around her dining room table and talk about everybody that wasn't there. And I learned that habit really, really young. And, you know, when I got kicked off the softball team, it was everybody else's fault. And I was going to tell them how bad the coach was and how bad the pitcher was and that new catcher wasn't as good as me. And I really let them know how those people were. And little did I know, it made me look really bad. But I was just trying to build myself up all the time because I wanted you to like me and I wanted you to think I was cool. And I just did that. And when I left Virginia Wesleyan College, I don't know how I got all A's and graduated with honors, but I had been kicked off the softball team. I had been kicked out of a sorority and for drinking too much. And how do you do that? That was my life. And I ended up going back to the Northern Neck to my parents because I couldn't find a job. I had gotten a degree in business management, and it doesn't do much for you. So I had this liberal arts degree, and I couldn't find a job in Virginia Beach. My parents couldn't afford to support me unless I was at home. So I went home, and I started applying for jobs around the Northern Neck, and I ended up just finding this job because I had to get one. I had to be able to afford my drinking, and, you know, I needed to party, so I needed a job. And I really didn't have that many responsibilities because my grandparents were paying for everything. My cell phone, my car insurance, different things. And once I got a job, they told me that I was responsible for the car insurance and my cell phone and all that stuff. But I got this job working in registration in an ER at a local hospital. And I worked 3 to 11 shift, and it was great for partying. I got to sleep until like 2. I went to work 3 to 11, and my friends were going out when I was getting off. So I would change in the bathroom at the hospital, and I'd be on my way, and I didn't have to be back till 3 the next afternoon. And, you know, the story just played on. I did that for a really long time. I was registering patients, and in between I was running to the doctor's bathroom to get sick because I was just so hungover, or I just needed more. I don't really know, but I was sick, and I just thought that was perfectly okay. It never crossed my mind to not drink, so I didn't feel sick at work. It just never did. So I didn't want to be a registrar in an ER making $10 an hour for the rest of my life with a college degree. So I decided that what those nurses were doing back in the ER was what I wanted to do. And they told me that I could go to community college, and I thought I was too good for community college. So I talked my grandparents into sending me to VCU to nursing school. And I went to nursing school at VCU and worked night shift at the hospital. I switched to night shift in registration, and they eventually had a position as a cardiac monitor tech on the telemetry floor, and I transferred to that floor to get a little experience while I was in school. And I worked 3 nights a week, 12 hours, and I worked full-time, and my grandparents thought it was great that I was working full-time and going to school, so they just kept giving me money. And 3 nights in a row working and being off 4, it just set me sailing. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a really small town that I was in, and, you know, the bars were like an hour and a half away from my parents' house, and I would drive obliterated all the time. I got stopped on several occasions, just talked my way out of it. All the cops in that town knew me. All the cops in the next town knew me. They would have you know, the little road checks where they do the breathalyzers, and I'd blow so high, and the cops would be like, you know, we told you last week. And I would look at them and say, whatever I have to do. And I won't tell you what I had to do, but I did it, so I didn't have to go to jail, and they didn't have to call my parents. And that became my life. So I was living like that, with cops and trying to get myself out of trouble. And I thought that was perfectly okay because no one was going to know. And I was going to work at this hospital and I was going to school, and I just started hanging out with worse and worse and worse crowds. I continued to hang out with my friends that like I went to college with and that I went to high school with and that kind of thing, but eventually they were just like, Mallory, you're so mean when you drink vodka, and you're so mean when you drink beer, and you're so mean when you pee the bed when you drink wine, you know, just all these things, and I didn't want to hear it. I just wanted to drink, so I eventually pushed those people out of my lives, whether it was stealing from them, just getting mad at them, them telling me not what I wanted to hear, you know, whatever it was, I was going to drink, and they were going to be history. And that's the way it went. I, you know, just kept learning new circles of people to drink with. And I ended up drinking with, this is really important to my story, and I don't know why I didn't tell you guys in the beginning, but I grew up in a very Republican racist family. And my grandparents, who I was living with, I mean, I just can't explain how disappointing it would be for them, for me to be hanging out with people that were not white. And I ended up hanging out with cocaine-dealing black guys, and I was dating them and living in this... Well, I wasn't living, but I was pretty much living with them and their families and hiding from my family because I didn't want them to know where I was because I was afraid my grandfather would cut me off, and I wanted to be able to support myself and this guy who loved me. So I, you know, that's what I did, and I hung out with these people for a long time, and eventually this drug dealing guy took my car that my grandparents had co-signed for, but I was paying for, and they had switched the car insurance over to me, and I hadn't paid it in 3 months because the bar tabs were more expensive than car insurance, you know. And I sent him on his way. It was his 28th birthday, and I was partying it up in his parents' yard, drinking tequila, which is what I loved. And he called me about 15 minutes after he left, and they had totaled my car and had 4 pounds of cocaine in my trunk, and he told me I had to come get him. And I was afraid he wouldn't like me anymore, so I went and got him, and I took the rap for him. And he took his car back to his parents' house, and it was just a spiral out of control from there. He did not care that he had wrecked my car. It was my fault because I had not paid the car insurance, which it was, and I did let him drive the car. But I think like that was the realization, like, this guy doesn't care about me. All he wanted was my money, which I didn't have any, so I don't know how I kept having it to give to him. But, you know, we come up with stuff. We just do. And so I went and got a rental car the next day, and coming back across the bridge from where I went to get the rental car, Enterprise calls, and they're like, Miss Revere, your car is not going to be covered by your insurance company. You need to bring it back, or you need to give us a credit card number. And I was like, well, are you going to charge it right now? Because there was nothing on my card. Like, it was maxed out. And they were like, yes, ma'am, we need to put this amount on there. And I was just like, all right, well, I'm going to call them right now. I'll take care of it. And, I mean, I knew deep down that I hadn't paid my car insurance, and that was probably why. But I wasn't going to tell the people in the car with me that, and I wasn't going to tell them that, because what would they think of me? So eventually I had to take the car back, and I owed Enterprise for, like, 4 days of driving the car. They eventually called me and said, if you don't bring this car back, we're reporting it to the police stolen. And I was like, okay, I'm coming. I didn't like the police involved in anything. So I was 22 years old. I was $200,000 in credit card debt. And I still don't know how I was that far into debt. I don't know where that money went. I don't know what I bought. But my life felt like it was over. Sometimes I think, like, you didn't have that bad of a bottom, but it was bad. Those feelings that I had inside, I just cannot explain it. I felt like life was just over. There was nothing to live for. It sucked. And I had created it, but I didn't realize that at the time. I went to work one night. I came home. That happened on July 4th of 2010. No, it didn't. It happened June 1st of 2010. July 4th of 2010, I partied my butt off and drank a lot of tequila like I like to do. And I went to work on July 5th and worked night shift, and I came downstairs in my parents' house because they had their own house by then. I wasn't still living at my grandparents' house. And I came downstairs and I sat on the floor Indian style in front of my mom's recliner, and I just cried. And I said, I cannot do this anymore. And she's like, do what? And I was just like, I can't stop drinking. And she's like, you can't? She really just thought that I was a 22-year-old that was going to grow out of it like she did when she was in college. And she had no idea the life that I was living. I was just living this double life. I was being this daughter that was working and going to school full time. And on the other side, everyone in town that knew me thought I was a whore that drank too much. And so, being the enabling parent that she is, bless her heart, she got me help, and thank goodness that she did. So I went to this treatment center for 8 weeks. I called the hospital and told them that I needed time off from work, and they helped me. They told me that they wanted me to get better. They were shocked that I had a problem. They really didn't know. And I knew that my job was over, and I really wanted to be at that hospital because when I graduated nursing school, I wanted to be able to work there. And I just knew that they weren't going to let me come back, even though they said that I'd be fine when I came back. So I went to treatment for 8 weeks. And it was an IOP program in Richmond, but I was driving back and forth. My parents were actually taking me because they didn't trust me at all at that point. And from the Northern Neck to Richmond, it was a 2-hour drive each way. So they drove me for 8 weeks, 4 days a week. And gas was really high back then, too. So they took me back and forth, and I was going to this clinic, and I was listening to what everyone else said. And, you know, we sat in a big circle, and people would be like, my name's so-and-so, and I'm an addict. My name's so-and-so, and I have a problem with this. My name's this, and I'm an alcoholic. And I just be like, my name's Mallory, and I am in trouble. That's all I knew, was that I was in trouble. And I was in trouble. And I don't know what happened, but after like 2 weeks, I was worried about what they thought of me. Because they were all getting better, and I could see it, and they were laughing, and I was still just sitting there with my arms crossed like, I'm Mallory, and I'm still in trouble. So I finally said that I was an alcoholic, because I knew I was. I could relate to everything those people were saying in that meeting, and all those, you know, we all had to do our first step before we graduated, and every time one of them told their story and their first step, oh my goodness, I related to every one of them, regardless of what they were addicted to. So I lose my track of thought. So at week 7, they had been suggesting that we go to AA meetings, like at least once a week, because we were going to this like 4 times a week. And I was not going to AA because I heard that when you go to AA, like the judge sends you there if you get a DUI. And I didn't get a DUI, remember? I got out of them. So I just didn't think it applied to me. I wasn't going. And about week 7, I got scared because I realized all of those people that had been supporting me for 7 weeks weren't going to be there next week. They were all graduating. And, like, I couldn't do it alone. That's why it's a WE program, because I can't do this alone. So I went to this meeting in the Northern Neck after leaving Richmond that day. And I walked in this church. Mind you, I parked, like, way down the street because I didn't want anybody to see me at church. And it was a Catholic church, too, and I really didn't want people to see me there. So I walked in the church. I was about an hour early because I don't like to be late. And there was this man, and he was obviously some kind of carpenter or contractor. And he was sitting at, like, you know, the long, like, 8-foot tables with these boots on that looked disgusting. He was scarfing down Chinese food. He had on a bandana that was gross. He looked like he hadn't showered in days. And I was just like, oh, my God, I'm in the wrong place. And I just really wanted to leave at that moment because I didn't like Chinese food, and I don't dress like him. And, you know, that's how I compared out for a long time. My whole life, I wasn't like you just because our outsides didn't match. And another man walks in. He's got this cowboy hat on. He's got a rope tied around his waist, pulled in a knot like a belt. And I'm like, that's a belt to you? And, you know, I just kept comparing out. And, you know, the room filled up. And they were like, you know, there's going to be a lot of women here. They just normally get here a little late. And so these two people from the hospital that I worked at walked in the door, like, right before the meeting started. And they shut the door. And these two women were sitting beside the door I would have to walk out of if I decided to leave, and I really wanted to leave because they were going to go back to the hospital and tell everybody that I was there. And I don't know how they would know that if they weren't there, but at the time, I thought that it was all about me, and I didn't want anybody to know what was going on with me. So I sat in that meeting, And when they went around the room and asked if anyone was new, I said however many days I had. And I had been sober for 8 weeks at that time. And I never got a white chip because I was afraid of what people thought of me. And I knew I was coming up on 60 days. And I didn't want to pick up a white chip and then pick up a 60-day chip like 2 days later. So my first chip was a 60-day chip because they did every month. And so I think when they gave out chips the first time, they were like, yeah, do you want this? And I'm just like, no, I got more time than that. So after the meeting, this lady walks up to me, and she's like, I'm so glad you're here. And she hugs me. And, you know, she was a pretty high-up nurse at this hospital, and she was hugging me, and she had never even spoken to me before at work. And little do you know, she later became my sponsor, and we had a really good relationship for a couple of years. And that woman taught me how to do a lot of things sober, because I had no idea how to do stuff without tequila. I just didn't. I had, you know, grown up in my, from 13, 14 to 22, just learning how to do things pretty much drunk, but just not drunk enough for people to notice. And then it got to the point where people always knew Mallory's drunk. So I left that meeting with a little bit of hope, and they said, you know, when is your next meeting? And they showed me a couple meetings, and they showed me this meeting on the meeting list called the Shady Ladies in Irvington, Virginia. And those women, I don't care if any of them are there when I go back. Every time I go home on a Wednesday, if I can get there at noon, I get there. And I don't care if there's not a face I don't know, but that room saved my life. These women, you know, they taught me that not everybody stays sober. They taught me that if I want to stay sober, they have a way to do it. And they also taught me that regardless of whether or not I think I like a person, I can love them if they have the same problem that I do. And I was always one of those people, like, you don't dress like me, so I don't want anything to do with you. Or, I mean, I just was so material. And sometimes it still pops up, and I'm still that Mallory. And I have to constantly remind myself that that is not the way the world works, Mallory. So I eventually went back to work, and I didn't want anyone to know what had been going on. You know, they made up stories like I got pregnant, I had an abortion, all this stuff. Maybe I was going to be a surrogate. I mean, they didn't know. But they sure made it up, and they were asking a lot of questions, and I wasn't going to divulge any information. And this woman, I mean, she just simply said, you know, we've really missed you. We really like you on our floor. Where have you been? And I was just like, I've been in treatment. I'm an alcoholic. And I had, like, made this big deal about not telling anyone. So, you know, that actually, like, really helped me. It helped me to be honest with my coworkers and not hide, because I had hidden for so long. And I got honest with them, and I told them my problems. And, you know, after I got sober and was sober for a while, I helped a lot of those women just from sharing my story. So I got the sponsor. I didn't ask her to sponsor me, like, at that first meeting, but after a couple of the Shady Ladies meetings, I asked her to sponsor me, and the other nurse that worked with me, she was being sponsored by this woman, and I just thought, you know, us nurses can stick together. I wasn't quite a nurse yet, but I was going to be one. And so I started working with this woman, and she was a Wiccan, and I was a little scared, because I got in her house, and I saw all this weird stuff, and I was just like, what is going on? And I mean, I wasn't a Christian, I don't think. I didn't really know what I was, but I knew I didn't want to be a witch because I just thought that I was going to have this big pot and, like, stir it. That's what I thought. So the reason that I picked this woman is not because she worked with me or that I was scared of her or any of that stuff. It was because she was so serene and I was wound so tight that I just wanted part of the serenity that she had. So I decided I was going to work with her. I went to her house for the first time, and I looked around and was a little scared. And we did the first and second step all on the first day, because she had I mean, she just had heard me in meetings sharing, and she's like, you've got the first step, honey. So I got to the fourth step pretty fast, but it took me to do my fifth, like 9 months. And when I got to 9 months, she said, you've put it off long enough. Do you want to work with me anymore? Well, don't say you're going to push me away. I can push you away, but you can't push me away. So I got it done, and I did my fifth step because I didn't want to have to find a new sponsor. And thank goodness I did. I found a power greater than myself, which, you know, when I was a young child, I didn't go to church, but I had these ideas that, you know, it talks about in the 12 and 12 how we have this, like, Santa Claus God, and that's what I had. I would, like, pray for stuff, and it wouldn't happen, and I'm like, it doesn't exist. And that was the God that I was mad at for making this stuff happen to my family, making all these material things that I wanted not come to me. You know, just me, I want. And I didn't need anything except a higher power. So she kept telling me, like, I had to have this higher power. And this was before the fourth and fifth step. She told me I had to come up with one, and it was really hard for me to do. Because I just had this concept that you don't understand what God has done to me. And she was like, it doesn't have to be the God of your childhood. And it took me a really long time to understand that. But it eventually became the water. I grew up on the river, and I could just understand that the water was a lot bigger than me. And I found myself praying on my parents' dock every morning and at sunset at night when I was off. And, like, I had this, like, little sound machine in my room. And, like, when I got home, when it was dark, I would listen to the water part of it. And, I don't know, it just made me kind of serene. So I just believed that the water was my higher power, and it worked for a really long time. And I later got to, like, you know, the eighth and ninth step, and I was totally willing to write everything down and do the fourth and fifth, and I was willing to ask to get rid of it, and I was willing to make that eighth step list, but I don't know that I ever really thought that I would get to the ninth step and really mean it. And when I got to the ninth step with my sponsor, well, actually, when I got to the ninth step and I just was ready to do it, I was ready to do it. And I was ready to go to all those cops' wives. And I was ready to, like, go right to Dillard's in Virginia Beach and say, I probably stole $20,000 worth of stuff from you. What do you want me to do about it? Arrest me now. You know, I was just ready to do all this stuff. And thank goodness I had a sponsor. She was just like, that's not how it goes. This is what we're going to do. And, you know, I made a lot of amends that first year, and a lot of them went really well, and I paid a lot of money back in my first 4.5 years of sobriety. A lot of money. You know, that $220,000 in credit card and student loan and all that stuff, debt that I had just ignored. Another thing that I forgot to say is my mailbox was just a death trap for me. I could not go to the mailbox. I had a post office box, and what I would do was, like, go, like, every 3 weeks maybe, and I'd pull everything out and throw it in the trash because if I didn't see it, it didn't exist. And that's what I did for a long time. She taught me how to open my mailbox and prioritize my bills. And, you know, normal people know how to do that. But I don't know how to do that. I still don't without people's help in AA. I can get scared if a bill collector finds me from years ago today, 5.5 years sober, and I'll want to throw it in the trash, but I call my sponsor today. There is stuff that it still pops up that I don't remember doing. And when it pops up, I try to take care of it. She helped me to, you know, call all these companies. You're going to pay them $5 a month until it's paid off. And I'm just like, I owe them $20,000. What's $5? And she's like, believe me, they'll take it. And they did. They also, like, wrote off a lot of the interest, and I was shocked at that because, I mean, that's what had made it so great. So my credit card debt is now paid off, and I did get my nursing license, And I owe it to AA and the Northern Neck of Virginia, because I could not have stayed sober long enough to do all that stuff. So after I got my nursing degree, I worked for a while between an ER and a telemetry floor, and working with cardiac patients and working in an ER in a town where it's pretty much a retirement community, it was depressing because everyone was dying. And I also learned after I got sober that I'm very codependent. And when you're dying and I have to deal with your family afterwards crying, I'm going to cry too. And I'm going to take it home with me. I can't leave it at work. So I realized that I couldn't work with geriatric patients very long, or I was going to be in a psych ward. So I switched to palliative care, where they're definitely dying. The reason that I did that was because my mom's brother, who was 52 years old when I was a year and a half sober, was diagnosed with Hep C, and he was on a liver transplant list, but he couldn't stop drinking long enough to stay on the list for 3 weeks before they took him off. And he was, you know, he just had a matter of time to die, and he just couldn't stay sober. And back when I went into treatment and my parents were having a hard time with money, like they were putting it all towards their house, I remember my uncle telling them, whatever you need, I don't care if it's $30,000, you just tell me and I'll send her. And I never realized it was because he couldn't get his life together. He wanted to make sure I could get mine together. I didn't realize that. But he ended up in palliative care, and he ended up alone. Daughter wanted nothing to do with him. His wife divorced him when he went into the hospital. His mother and father, who were my grandparents, had just disowned him because he was a failure and he wouldn't get himself together. My mom was mad at him for treating his daughter the way that he had. My dad was his friend, and that's like how he met his wife. And, you know, like, dad had nothing to do with him because he was just this mean drunk. And at a year and a half sober, I was able to sit in the hospital in Richmond with him and hold his hand while he died. And it meant so much to me because I just understood what this man was going through. I had been through it. I really like people, and I want people to like me, and he didn't give a crap about people. So it was a lot easier for me to ask for help than it was for him. So he died, and I just realized that there are so many people dying on palliative care that don't have anybody. So I decided that I was going to be that person. Well, talk about depressed. I just took it all on, and I wanted to be there for all those people, and I was taking overtime because it was a really short staff floor, and I was killing myself working night shift and overtime, and, you know, mentally I was just drained. So I got this crazy idea to move to Charlottesville, Virginia. I had partied at UVA. I went to a wedding at UVA, and I went to an AA meeting there, to the Preamblers group, when I came for this wedding. And that was like the only thing that I knew was this Preamblers meeting, and I knew that I would make friends in AA. And I knew that I could get a job at UVA or Martha Jefferson. So I got an apartment in Charlottesville. And I moved to Charlottesville with no job. And I put in my resignation at the other job. And I moved. I came up here, and I could not get into either hospital. And I was panicking because I had bills to pay, and I had rent now, and I didn't know what I was going to do. So I started working at this eye doctor's office as a tech because I couldn't get a nursing job. It's apparently just really hard because there's so many applicants, they didn't even see my application. And I just went to a lot of meetings. And I really believe that was my higher power doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, because I was moving to this town trying to get away from my angry family that was mad at alcoholism because of my uncle, get away from, you know, dealing with what my parents had been through, even though it had been years. Like, they still have this tension in that house. I feel it every time I go home. And I just, you know, I moved here, and I went to a lot of meetings, and I believe that I got the job that I needed because I needed to go to a lot of meetings and get established with a lot of people in Charlottesville, and I did that. And I went to noon meetings, and I went to 8 o'clock meetings, and I had people over to my house, and they had me over to theirs, and we went to dinner. And I have a really good group of core friends in AA, and I go to a meeting just about every day, and if I'm not there, somebody's calling me. They're like, did you go to a different meeting tonight? We missed you. And it just, nobody used to care about me. I used to think they did, and I used to think that if I didn't go to the bar, they were going to notice. They didn't notice. All they noticed was that they had to walk out on their bar tab because I wasn't picking it up on my grandparents' credit card. So I paid off that car that I totaled last month. I finally paid it off. And my grandparents gave me a minivan to drive that was just kind of their extra car while I paid all this stuff off. And I'm still driving that car because I refuse to have a car payment right now. I've had to do a couple of little things to that, but, you know, it was given to me, and I just ride it around with pride. I eventually got a job at UVA. I work in labor and delivery. I deliver babies on a regular basis, and it's a really joyful job. I don't have to be depressed most of the time at work. There's occasions that it's not so happy, but most of the time it's a really joyful job. This past year, I applied to nurse practitioner school at UVA, and I got in, so I'm going to family nurse practitioner school to do women's health. And my employer is paying for it, thank goodness. And as long as I get good grades, and I know that I can do that as long as I stick close to the program. And I like to make excuses that I work full-time and do school full-time, just like I did back then. But I have to do AA full-time before anything. I go to meetings just about every day. If there's people in Charlottesville that are coming in new or going out and coming back in, like, it's very rare for me not to know who they are. I went out of town for, like, a week to see my boyfriend a couple weeks ago, and this girl that I sponsored when I first came here is back in the rooms, and everybody was like, this girl's looking for you. And I'm like, what do you mean? I've been at meetings. I haven't seen this person. And it just means so much to me that, like, everybody knows who I am, because for so long I was hiding, and I was, like, being this person to this group of people and this person to this group of people. And it's like, I can just be Mallory, and it's just one Mallory today. It's not 10 of them. So another thing that I really like to talk about is how much people in AA have given to me. When I moved to Charlottesville, I had this house, and, you know, it's my way of life when I'm not working a program to not pay bills. And after I started working for that eye doctor's office, I wasn't making an RN salary. And I still wanted to spend money like I had an RN salary. So I didn't pay rent, and I spent my money. And I eventually got evicted. And there was a woman in town that let me move in with her, and she did not know me from Adam. All she knew was that I was a girl that came to AA, and that I had a job, and that I could help her out because she kind of needed the money and I kind of needed a space to live. And her child welcomed me with open arms, and I learned so much from that woman and her child. And little do you know, I screwed her over. It's just what I do when I'm not working a program. And I was, you know, living at her house, and I wasn't going to very many meetings because it was kind of out of town, and I wasn't doing what I needed to do. So she asked me to leave, and I went willingly because I knew why she had asked me to leave. But she handled that situation with such grace. You know, every time she sees me in a meeting, she hugs me. I made amends to her, like, right away. I can't believe how much that woman embraced me after I just point blank, like, stole from her. So I have since gotten a different house after I moved out of hers. I lived with a friend for about 2 weeks before my house was ready. And again, like, this friend knew me from AA, but she really didn't know me. And I talked about how I was a thief, and she still let me move into her house. And it just blew my mind that, you know, these people trusted me. And that particular person just said, you know, Mallory, you're telling us what you're doing. So I know if stuff goes missing at my house, who it is, don't do it. So I was living at this girl's house for 2.5 weeks before my current house was ready for me to move into and rent. And, you know, it was just a really good experience. I did what I was supposed to do for the first time ever. And, you know, it's a big deal to me. It's so stupid. I'm almost 30 years old, and sometimes it's really hard to just be an adult. So I have since in this house, tomorrow will be a year of me living in this house and paying rent on a regular basis, and that is incredible to me. I can't believe somebody's had me in their house for a year and I've actually paid rent. And I have had 4 or 5 people in AA go in and out of my house, and one of them really, really burned me over the summer. And I felt like what goes around comes around. And I really felt burned, and it really hurt. And when that happened to me, I realized that I'd never do it again. Not have people in my house, but I'd never do it to someone again because I knew what it felt like, and I needed that to happen to me. Because I don't know. I mean, I had gotten caught a couple times, and I still kept doing it. But when it happens to you, it's just a little different. And I went through the steps again with my sponsor recently right after this happened, and you know, I just have such compassion for alcoholics, regardless of whether or not they're being honest with me or not. Because sometimes I don't know how to be honest with myself when I'm not going to meetings on a regular basis. I choose to do that today, go to meetings on a regular basis, but I don't always do it. I go through lulls where I'll do something and I think everybody's going to know it and I don't want to tell you and I'm just going to avoid meetings because you're going to find out. I mean, it's stupid stuff. Like, pay my electric bill 2 days late. I'll not go to a meeting because you might know. I mean, my pride is really big, and if I can't afford to do something, I don't want you to know because I've talked about that stuff, and I shouldn't be still doing it, you know? So, you know, when they read the 9-step promises when I first came in, and they talked about financial insecurity and how my past might help another person, I just thought, there is no way. And you know, like, if I just keep doing the next right thing, my bills get paid. I don't have to worry about how it's coming to me. I can have just the right amount of hours at work to pay my rent, and all of a sudden somebody will ask me to work for them, and I'll have overtime, and I'll be able to pay something else off. Like, it just works out if I just keep doing the right thing. And that's God doing for me what I can't do for myself, because my way of thinking is I'm going to take from you and then I'm going to help you find who did it. So, you know, like AA has just, it's changed me. I'm really grateful to my home group. Preamblers has just been, they read in the book, and, you know, some people think it's a really boring meeting in a basement, but those guys, there's about 6 of them that were there when I got here, and they know me like a book. They can tell when my lips quivering, like, what's going on? You know, a couple of them have eaten dinner at my house several times. One of them has lived with me. One of them has represented me in court. You know, just different stuff. And I just can't express enough how important a home group is to me. When I decided to take from someone and got asked to leave their house, I didn't go to my home group for about 8 months because I was afraid they were going to know what I had done. And I wasn't in a very good place. So I'm really glad that right now I'm working in programs to the best of my ability, that I'm, you know, blessed to help women deliver babies, and it's a joy to me. And I'm able to, like, work with other women in AA and help them out when they ask for my help. When I first got to Charlottesville, I used to think that every young woman I needed to, like, tell what she should do. And I learned really fast, like, that's not what you do. If they ask for my help, I can help them. But if they don't ask, I don't need to open my mouth. I still have that sitting around my grandmother's table and talking about everyone that's not there. And I have friends and a sponsor that constantly say, they're not here. Because I have told them to tell me that. It is so ingrained in me, I have to be told all the time. And when I do a tenth step at night, I do a written tenth step at night before I go to bed every night in this journal. When I look back at the stuff that I used to write in this tenth step and the stuff that I write now, it's so much shorter. I don't have to make nearly as many amends. I'm definitely not perfect. I have to make amends all the time, but they're little, and they're for, like, being snarky at work and, you know, just dumb stuff. But it's not for stealing. And, you know, like, I think that if my family ever knew my entire story, they would think that I was, like, a person that they never met if they heard my story. Because I just don't want to... I don't want to scare them with my story, really. I remember when I went to pick up my one-year medallion, my mom was like, "Are you sure you want me to come with you?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And she was so uncomfortable in that AA meeting that she never went back. And that's fine, because I get it. If you're not an alcoholic, it is kind of scary. One last thing I want to say is, you know, as I learned that I was codependent working in those hospitals and working with patients that were really sick, I also learned that in AA. I learned that when I had sponsees and they went back out, I blamed myself and I tried everything possible to bring them back in the room, and that is not my job. So I know this is an AA meeting, but I'm throwing in just a little tidbit of Al-Anon. Like, if you have a problem with codependency, that program works. And it has really done a big number on me the past year. I'm only able to go once a week, but it really helps. I really appreciate you asking me to come out, and I appreciate you all being here.